made that Trump is unlikely to pursue a diplomatic solution in Afghanistan because, well, for example, there's no U.S. ambassador there. The State Department had a special office working on a regional solution to the Afghan war, but Tillerson disbanded it. Your response to all this in 10 seconds.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this whole Trump's speech is a military solution which has been tried and tested and failed. And in fact, what it needs is more diplomatic engagement and some more attention towards State Department, where hundreds of positions apparently are lying vacant, including that of the representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. So I guess it's a bit of an alarming situation because this military solution has not worked over the past 16 years. How is it going to work now?
Raja Rumi, we have to leave it there. Pakistani journalist targeted by the Taliban in 2014. He now teaches at Cornell and Ithaca colleges. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's City Council votes on two police accountability measures.
House Speaker Paul Ryan's visit to Portland was met with over 200 protesters.
A kicker tax break has been initiated, much to the relief of many Oregonians.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 24th, 2017. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. White House Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke released a statement that, quote, unspecified boundary adjustments for some of the 27 national monuments, end quote, were among his recommendations submitted to President Trump. Zinke delivered a report to Trump earlier this morning where he outlined his suggestions to decrease the boundaries for national monuments. One of the monuments that Zinke called for the downsizing of is the Cascade Siskiyou Monument here in Oregon. The report contains monuments totaling more than 100,000 acres approved and expanded under the Obama, Clinton, and Bush administrations. He relayed to the Associated Press that he did not recommend the removal of any monuments or the selling of the land they are on. National Parks Conservation President and CEO Teresa Pierno stated that, quote, to recommend diminishing the size of just one national monument is one too many, end quote. The White House has not yet spoken on the nature of Zinke's report.
The so-called kicker tax rebate has been initiated, which has many Oregonians breathing a sigh of relief. From Oregon schools, however, you are more likely to hear a sharp intake of breath. KBOO News intern Kunsel Doma has more in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
Oregon state economists have announced the kicker tax rebate will go into effect next year, but economic analysts worry it is punting concerns over schools' financial woes down the road. Many Oregonians see a reason to celebrate the $464 million rebate, which will send money their way in next year's tax returns. But Juan Carlos Ordonez of the Oregon Center for Public Policy says the majority of refund money will go to the wealthiest Oregonians, while the average resident will receive about $89. Meanwhile, public schools will find themselves in a deeper hole.
We're in a situation where schools continue in this long-term chronic underfunding, and yet here we have a situation where the state is going to be creating an automatic tax cut worth $464 million, and that's money that would have been definitely better spent investing in our schools.
The kicker is triggered when state revenue is 2% or higher than state economists' predictions 2 years earlier. Ordonez says it would have been more prudent to set the money aside in Oregon's rainy day fund, which would be useful in the event of a future economic downturn. State lawmakers had a chance to suspend the kicker during this year's session, but did not. To understand the scale of the kicker, the Oregon Center for Public Policy found the state could have added more than 2,600 teachers to its ranks. The state is sorely in need. It has the third largest class sizes on average in the nation. But Ordonez says these issues aren't considered when calculating the kicker.
It has nothing to do with what Oregonians need or want from their public services, to the quality of services that they want, of how big our class sizes are in our schools, of things like that. It's divorced from that reality.
Even before the kicker was initiated, schools and educators were looking for other ways to keep schools afloat. The Oregon Education Association is backing a 2018 ballot initiative to increase corporate taxes in order to fund schools and other initiatives that would make it easier for legislators to do this.
That was KBOO News intern Kunsel Dolma in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
Portland City Council voted on two police accountability measures today. KBOO's Sam Bowman has this report.
The Portland City Council met today to, among other business, vote on two police accountability measures carried forward with amendments from 2 weeks ago. The first would establish the Portland Commission on Community Engaged Policing, or PCEP, a new community oversight group. The commission was panned as being toothless and not compatible with the city's settlement agreement with the Department of Justice by numerous citizens and watchdog groups at previous city council meetings. The city took the rare move of taking community feedback into account, as the Reverend Dr. T. Allen Bethel of the Albina Ministerial Alliance for Justice and Police Reform, or AMAC, pointed out in his remarks, without holding back some of his remaining criticisms of the proposal.
The AMAC wants to affirm the city for hearing the voice of the stakeholders and citizens about their concerns and the seriousness of them. Thank you for adopting many of the ideas of the stakeholders in this new proposed Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, known as PCEP Plan, and the city moving in a direction to enhance community policing and engagement. The following are some areas that we still have some concern about, and we've tried to identify them by section or page that remain about the PCEP, and a few suggestions we believe will improve the goals of the PCEP as we continue to work on the assessment and implementation of the settlement agreement. Under section two, when we speak of goals, we affirm that PCEP members' goals. However, we suggest that not only is it to independently assess the settlement agreement, but the implementation as well be added there, that they report on progress and non-progress as it relates to the settlement agreement.
Portland NAACP member Lisa Wright read a statement from that group's president, Joanne Hardesty, pointing out that whether or not council approves changes to the settlement agreement, the PCEP still goes against the spirit of the original settlement.
We are disappointed that the city continues to pursue the PCEP and the elimination of the COAB. This change has been opposed by the NAACP, AMAC, the Oregonian Editorial Board, Portland Cop Watch, and Kathleen Sadat, the former COCOL, in addition to hours of testimony by Portland residents. Although it is evident that the city has attempted to incorporate feedback from the community, it has still failed to articulate its case for the elimination of the COAB instead of repairing those structural and leadership problems from the city and the police bureau. The proposed ordinance goes to great lengths to outline the timelines and culpability and the details of negotiations, but it fails to address the conclusion that the community should no longer have independent oversight of the settlement agreement. None of the findings in the ordinance, outlined in the ordinance, justify this change. In short, you have not made your case.
The other measure addresses the ongoing give and take over the 48-hour rule. The original rule gave officers who use deadly force a 48-hour heads-up before they give an interview to internal affairs investigators. The rule was scrapped to much fanfare during the negotiations over the new police union contract last year, but was quietly reinstated with an even longer window early this year. The new measure aims to formally and finally scrap the rule, while directing the city attorney to seek a legal opinion on whether the administrative investigation could interfere with the concurrent criminal investigation of the same shooting by the same officer. Police accountability advocates showed up to, much like Dr. Bethel, thank council for listening to the community and still lay out their remaining criticisms of the measure.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and Council. My name is Juan Chavez. I'm here testifying on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild Portland Chapter. First, the NLG would like to thank the Mayor and the City Council for continuing to listen to the public and developing its deadly force directive. The proposal before you today is a great improvement that just needs a few amendments. First, the NLG's greatest concern centers around the interviews of involved members and witnesses. The city has provided no reason why involved members are not required to submit to an interview promptly after a deadly force incident. The community has asked for compelled testimony by the end of the shift, or at the very least within 24 hours. But the directive still allows up to 48 hours for involved member interviews. The directive also does not provide an outer time limit for when witness members must be interviewed. Lastly, the directive allows discretion in some circumstances to not audio record interviews with involved witnesses and witness members.
That was Juan Chavez of the Portland branch of the National Lawyers Guild at Portland City Council this afternoon. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
Just before we went on the air this evening, we learned that both measures passed unanimously.
The historic ancient Order of the United Workmen Temple building in downtown Portland is being demolished to make way for a 20-story boutique hotel. Also known as the Torney Building, the former landmark was built in 1892 and designed by Justice F. Crumbine, the architect that also designed the Oregon State Capitol building in Salem. Located on Southwest 2nd Avenue and Taylor Street, this Richardsonian Romanesque giant is easily recognizable with its brick facade and upper-level pillars. The building underwent a fire that gutted the top three stories in 1946. After being repaired, the building made it to the Historic Landmark Registry, but was later removed due to a paint job that lessened its value. There's still a little time to say goodbye to this classic downtown Portland building before it is completely razed.
Volunteering can help heal community wounds, especially in regions where food is scarce and most people are on vacation. Here to talk about it more is KBOO's Grace Ann Smith in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
With the country going through a divisive and stressful time, could volunteering be one answer for healing local communities? Recent events like the protest in Charlottesville have left many Americans looking for ways to make a more positive impact. It may not be the action-packed scene of a protest, but volunteering is a tangible way for Oregonians to improve lives in their communities. John Steubenville with Oregon Food Bank says this is the best time of the year to lend a helping hand.
People have family plans, family vacations, and so many organizations, in fact, do not have enough volunteers right now. So this is an excellent time for folks to come in and volunteer at Oregon Food Bank or any number of other organizations.
He notes that Oregon is also in the middle of harvest season, a time when volunteering is lowest, but people are needed most. Steubenval says the need for food assistance is high in the state. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the rate of food insecurity in Oregon is about 16%. Kyla Obal is a volunteer coordinator at Marion Polk Food Share, a food bank in Salem.
I feel like our volunteers enjoy volunteering because it makes them feel like they're a part of something and they're helping out their community. Also, they're working side by side with a diverse amount of people.
Obal says the food share is especially in need of people to sort donated food into family-sized portions and drivers to deliver food through the Meals on Wheels program. Steubenval says Oregonians have not recovered equally from the economic downturn a decade ago, and food banks across the state remain busy.
All boats have not risen in this economic recovery, and so folks often come in to the food bank, their local food pantry, really on a regular basis, simply to make ends meet month over month.
In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, I'm Grace Ann Smith. Last spring, the Sinclair Broadcast Group received a leg up in its acquisitions department when Trump chose FCC Chairman Ajit Pai to be the chief of the Federal Communications Commission. Pai has revived a regulatory loophole that prevents organizations from exceeding federal limits on media ownership. Sinclair Broadcast Group has earned a reputation for being a conservative television company. The Washington Post last December reported that the Sinclair Broadcasting Group gave a disproportionate amount of neutral or favorable coverage to Trump during his campaign, compared to repeated negative coverage of Hillary Clinton. Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, has boasted that President Trump's campaign had previously struck a deal with Sinclair for better media coverage. Kushner has since denied this statement. Last April, the Sinclair Broadcast Group hired former White House aide Boris Epstein, who has organized Trump's TV partnerships, as an actual on-air political analyst. Sinclair plans to buy 42 stations from Tribune Media in cities coast to coast in the U.S., on top of more than 170 stations it currently owns.
The 45th president has recently given his blessing over brand new television programming intended to counteract what he has dubbed fake news. Over the last several weeks, the president's Facebook page has begun to feature short video clips colloquially titled Trump TV. The segments aim to provide the president's followers with real news. Each segment, except for one, has been anchored by Lara Trump, the president's daughter-in-law. Kayleigh McEnany, Republican National Committee spokesperson and one-time CNN political commentator, has hosted at least one segment. Trump TV segments are coming under fire as state-run propaganda, since they are being distributed on the president's official social media account and are funded by the president's re-election campaign. The segments often feature the anchors opening each report with a statement, quote, providing you the news for the week from Trump Tower here in New York, end quote, while also producing generalized remarks about the 45th's contributions to the United States. One such account reported by Kayleigh McEnany is that Trump has contributed over 1 million jobs to the U.S. since being in office. The Department of Labor's tally was actually about 860,000 jobs as of June, and has further issued reports that employment has maintained similar numbers since 2016. Hosts of Trump TV and each segment, by describing the clips as real news, in an interview with the Christian Broadcasting Network, Lara Trump hit back in response to backlash from Trump's support base, as well as other organizations and peer groups, saying, the reality is, if we had a fair shake within the regular news cycle, we wouldn't feel the need to post this sort of thing. It's not propaganda, because it's true.
Tune in after this newscast at 5:45 for KBOO News In-Depth, featuring an interview with Dan Hemry, a member of the Phoenix Cop Watch who was present at Tuesday night's counter-protest of the president's rally. In this clip, Hemry talks to KBOO reporter Sam Bowman about Phoenix Cop Watch's past actions in opposition to the heavy-handed and racist law enforcement approach of the Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was indicted for profiling earlier this summer.
Did Cop Watch have much interaction with the county sheriffs under Joe Arpaio?
Well, our first interaction that was done on behalf of immigrants was in 2006, and we approached the sheriff with a group of us, and he had a whole bunch of reporters, and kind of crashed what we were doing, and so we had to confront him directly. But it was over him having people arrested and then convicting themselves for being their own coyote.
Huh.
I guess the state law said you weren't supposed to be a coyote, and so it was a more harsh punishment. And so it required that they self, like, incriminate.
And these are people who, I guess, were, like, traveling by themselves or were arrested by themselves?
I suppose that's right. It was a trick. The law was passed about dealing with coyotes, and then Maricopa's sheriff decided to arrest people and get them to try and indict themselves, you know, self-incriminate, which is not supposed to happen. And we confronted him about that and asked him to stop using the law the way it wasn't intended.
And so
that was before the massive marches. And so the massive marches took place maybe the next year in 2007 or 8. And that was definitely one of those things that we zeroed in on early and were first up to really confront the Sheriff's Department directly and Ohio directly about that.
That was Dan Hemry of the Phoenix Cop Watch speaking to KBOO's Sam Bowman. Stay tuned at 5:45 for the full interview, including discussion of Tuesday night's counter-protest, the police response, and how Maricopa County sheriffs are behaving with Arpaio out of the picture.
Today, KBOO News gives you a very different take on one of the stories of the day. We're calling it a radio news cartoon.
Radio News Cartoon brings you news from an alien perspective. KBOO has tapped into voice communications between an alien space outpost transmitting from a location in the vicinity of Crater Lake, Oregon, and a mothership in deep orbit over 1,000 miles from the Earth. Our understanding is that the aliens near Crater Lake have been put there in order to monitor Earth news and send reports via the mothership back to their home planet. For some reason that we don't understand, they have chosen to relay the KBOO evening news broadcast from Portland, Oregon, back to the mothership. Because KBOO has a self-monitoring loop, meaning that we copy ourselves on all rebroadcasts, the transmissions from Crater Lake location to the mothership feed back to the KBOO newsroom. Here's KBOO's report on August 24th.
President Trump announced this week that he has ordered the U.S. military to increase its presence in Afghanistan by as many as 4,000 additional troops. He did not offer any details about what difference the additional troops could make, given that the presence of as many as 100,000 soldiers in the 16 years that the U.S. military has already been in the country seems to have had no effect. Trump promised to put great pressure on neighboring Pakistan to stop harboring terrorist extremist groups, although he did not explain how this effort could be successful, given that the U.S. has been pressuring Pakistan for more than a decade. The president also appealed to NATO to send more troops, although NATO member countries appear to have given up on the war and have already been steadily withdrawing troops since announcing their exit strategy 3 years ago. While the president noted that Americans are war-weary after 16 years without apparent progress, he committed the nation to the indefinite future, and he refused to give a timetable, saying that this would only help the enemy. President Trump referred to a strategic planning process and noted that, quote, "In Afghanistan, you're right next to Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons, and we have to protect that. Nuclear weapons change the game," end quote. The president did not mention any plans he might have for dealing with North Korea, which is right next to China, which is right next to Pakistan. It's clearly a very complicated situation.
Now we hear the alien leader speaking from his platform in orbit above the Earth. He's talking with the two alien agents working from Crater Lake, Oregon.
What is Afghanistan and why is it important?
It's on the other side of the planet, and as far as we can tell, it's not important. It has no important resources, and its primary export is a medication that affects the minds of those who use it.
Did you apply our transparent orbital anomaly detector to the speech that the president made?
Yes, of course, leader. There was no affirmative verification in any sentence. He did not believe anything he said.
Why do the people of this country support such a thought process?
It appears that they have no choice. There is some dark force that seems to control the societal decision-making process. We are still trying to identify its source, but it seems to come from a group known as Koch Brothers, somewhere in a region known as Texas.
All right, then, you two. Keep monitoring KBOO's news transmissions. We have to figure out what's going on that planet. I'll need some better explanations of these events. Right now, they are not making sense.
Yes, leader. We'll be working on that.
We believe that the aliens intend to occupy Earth as soon as our planet will no longer support its current population. KABU will be monitoring these retransmissions closely, and our intent is to make direct contact with the alien agents and get the alien story direct from the source. We have a reporter on the ground in Crater Lake trying to locate them now.
Okay, we warned you that this would be a different take on a story of the day. As if the news weren't absurd enough just from the perspective of us Earthlings. We'd like to hear what you think of this cartoon approach.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report following up on the Phoenix counter-protest with Dan Henry. At 6 p.m., the Indigenous Power Hour mix takes us to new heights of beats, grooves, and decolonization. That's followed at 7 p.m. by Hard Knock Radio news, views, and from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, a low of 66 in the Portland area and a low of 65 in Hood River and a low of 56 on the coastlines near Lincoln City and Astoria. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland metropolis will be partly cloudy with a high of 82 and a low of 61, with similar conditions for our friends in the Dalles, Corvallis, and Hood River areas, slightly cooler on the coastline. Today in history, in 1992, Hurricane Andrew snapped palm and coconut trees with gusts of up to 160 miles per hour as it tore through South Florida on the way to the Gulf of Mexico. The quote of the day is from African American comedian, activist, writer, entrepreneur, and conspiracy theorist, actor Dick Gregory. I never learned hate at home or shame. I had to go to school for that.
It's 5:25. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Like rose blossoms, a politician's promises can be beautiful when they burst into full glorious bloom, only to see them fade over time and petal by petal fall away. Take Donald Trump's glorious pledge last year to renegotiate NAFTA and provide a, quote, much better deal for working families. Beautiful. This particular blossom is what convinced many hard-hit former factory workers to vote Trump into the White House. But the bloom is now off Trump's rosy promise, and it looks like working families will get nothing but thorns from him. A recently leaked copy of his NAFTA plan reveals that far from scrapping the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal, White House negotiators are goosing it up with even more power for multinational corporations. In particular, it includes new investor incentives to offshore thousands more of our middle-class jobs. Where did this come from? Right out of last year's discredited and defeated Trans-Pacific Partnership, a scam intended to enthrone corporate supremacy over our own laws. Indeed, the 500 corporate executives and lobbyists who essentially wrote that raw TPP deal have quietly been huddling with Trump's team to draft the plan for this new NAFTA. What about those working people Trump promised to help? Locked out, not even allowed to watch the negotiations, much less have a say in them. The same for consumers, environmentalists, farmers, even members of Congress are being left in the dark, allowed no voice in shaping the deal. This is Jim Hightower saying, but I'm guessing that the six Goldman Sachs executives Trump brought in to run our economic policy do have a say, along with his daughter and son-in-law, who oversee both our government and the extended Trump family's global business empire. It's the same old NAFTA story. Corporate powers are at the table. You and I are on the menu.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we have National Native News, a production of our friends at Native Voice One. Find them at nv1.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Recent discussions of removing Confederate statues across the country is reigniting a push in San Francisco to take down ones honoring settlers. Christina Onnestad has more. Native activists and supporters are calling on San Francisco city officials to remove what's called the Pioneer Monument. They spoke out at a recent public meeting.
This monument, it's definitely glorifying Spanish colonization of Native Americans. We have a Spanish vaquero who's got his fist pumping in the air, and he's standing triumphantly over a Native American laying on the ground.
And to see that breaks my heart, because that's not what my people and my culture is about. And to me, it's just a big disgrace.
Pioneer Monument was dedicated in 1894. More than a century later, to appease Native American scrutiny, city officials located a plaque at the base of it describing the negative impact settlers had on Native Americans in California. But critics say the plaque isn't enough and want the statue's removal. City officials plan to discuss the issue in October. That gives organizers time to plan. Some are also eyeing a statue of Columbus. Christina Onnested, National Native News.
Yale University will remove a stone carving of a settler pointing a gun at a Native American, the New Haven Register reports. Yale officials said this week the carving will be taken down from a library and placed in a location where it can be studied. The carving is an architectural feature attached to a wall, which acts as a support structure. Native students say the university should also acknowledge the history of indigenous people whose land the New Haven, Connecticut institution sits on. Federal officials have cleared the Navajo Nation Housing Authority of financial mismanagement and other alleged wrongdoing. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports it follows a recent investigation into the agency's operations.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development issued its final report this week on the tribal agency that provides housing to members. HUD investigators traveled to Arizona and New Mexico earlier this year to inspect contractor agreements and housing plans and conduct interviews. They concluded the Navajo Housing Authority is in compliance with federal regulations and statutes. The review, however, did find that a developer agreement from 2001 caused a housing project on the reservation to remain unoccupied. The tribe says it's since reformed many policies. An Arizona Republic investigative series last year triggered the federal review. It described misuse of billions in federal funds within the housing authority, along with fraud and waste. According to the Navajo Housing Authority, it's the largest rural housing agency in the U.S. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
A group in Rhode Island is occupying land which is owned by Brown University. An encampment was set up on Sunday claiming the land is ancestral territory of the Pokanoket Nation. Brown University officials met with some people occupying the area this week. In a statement, the university says it wants to focus on safety at the camp and work towards a resolution. The land is located in Bristol, Rhode Island, about 16 miles from the college campus in Providence. A music video paying tribute to the Standing Rock movement is nominated for an MTV Video Music Award. The video is included in the new category Best Fight Against the System. The song was recorded by Taboo of the Black Eyed Peas and several Native artists, including Superman and MC1. According to the artist, the song supports those who embrace the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in its fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The MTV Video Music Awards will air live from California on Sunday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Association of Machinists workers are on strike at Houston's Wyman Gordon plant. IAM District 37 President Byron Williams says the strike was triggered by the company trying to cut disability pay and wanting to start entry-level workers at lower pay, around $12 an hour, while also freezing those wages for 3 years.
The insult with the current workforce, our brothers and sisters, that they wanted to freeze those wages for 3 years, and with only periodic increases, it would take, if you did just simple math, it would take 50 to 60 years for an employee to reach from entry-level position to the top of that labor grade.
Williams says his union wants human rights and improving working conditions for workers, and he says IAM's strike spirit at Wyman Gordon is strong with support from the community and other unions. He gave special thanks to the IBEW.
We've had retirees and others from the community drop dropping off water and food, and everywhere we go, they're asking, it's funny, they was asking me, oh, are we having a party? I said, no, we're having a labor dispute with the company, and they was immediately sympathetic and wishing us well and wanted to donate. John Patrick from the state AFL is driving in for support. Annie Khalil from the Gulf Coast has lended a hand from the community. We've had our local 811 and local 2198 in transportation ready to lend a hand, and of course our international Bob Martinez and our general vice president Mark Blondin.
At a rainy Good Jobs Nation rally in Indianapolis this week, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders urged unity in the face of politically divisive hatred. He urged people to rally around a progressive workers' political agenda to overcome the billionaire class.
What we are doing here in Indianapolis is what must happen in every state in this country, and that is people standing together and demanding an economy and a government that represents all of us and not the 1%. Our job is not to allow them to divide us up. It is to bring our people together. And when we fight for an agenda and a government that works for all of us, we can do extraordinary things.
Workers Independent News is America's multimedia news voice for workers.
You don't clean this mess up,
we will be back.
We'll be back.
We will be back. We are the one that make the profit for Nissan. We are the one. UAW, strong, baby. UAW, strong.
Support WIN's Worker News mission at workersindependentnews.com and like us on Facebook. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now we hear from my friend Rick Smith. It's Labor History 2.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day that the United Farm Workers went out on strike against California lettuce growers. The United Farm Workers had led a successful boycott against grape growers that had drawn national attention to the harsh working conditions and low pay of those who harvested our nation's food. In an effort to keep the United Farm Workers from organizing lettuce workers, some of the growers had signed contracts with the Teamsters Union. The United Farm Workers argued that these contracts did not represent the workers' best interests. As thousands of workers went on strike, Cesar Chavez called for a national boycott of all non-union lettuce. In the lead-up to the strike, an estimated 4,000 workers attended a meeting in Salinas, California. One worker, Antonio Segredo, explained the importance of the action. Rael Macaredo, voice of the Farm Worker Newsletter, reported his words, quote, "Let the people and the government of the United States know that we are ready to work, but that we must have what we ask. It isn't very much. We don't ask the impossible, only that they look upon us as human beings. We have the same ambitions that they do. We have families. We have rights. Why must they continue to treat us like beasts of burden and look for a thousand ways to bring us down?" That December, Cesar Chavez was jailed for leading the boycott. Putting pressure on the growers through encouraging the public to boycott non-union harvested food was a key tactic for the farm workers' movement. It impacted the bottom line of the growers and moved them to sit down at the bargaining table.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Earlier today, a ferry sank off the shore of Salvador, Brazil, killing at least 22 people. 90 others have been pulled from the seas by Navy and private boats. The vessel had been carrying approximately 130 passengers and was on a short route from the island of Itaparica to Salvador. This marks the second tragic incident in the seas of Brazil this week. On Tuesday, a boat carrying about 70 passengers sank in the northern state of Pará. 21 people were killed, while another 5 are still reported missing. Rescue operation teams were able to save 23. Police are investigating what caused the ferry to sink, as well as whether it was carrying more passengers than permitted.
On Tuesday, police in the Saudi Arabian port city of Jeddah arrested a 14-year-old boy for dancing the Macarena. The boy, whose name has not been released, was filmed by amused observers as he performed the dance in a crosswalk last year. The video was uploaded to social media and taken down not long after, but the law caught up with the boy this week. Police accused him of, quote, improper public behavior and interrupting traffic. It has not been announced whether or not he will be formally charged or he will be released. Earlier in August, in the city of Taif, the singer Abdallah Al-Shahani was arrested for doing the dab dance on move on stage. Authorities in the country have even produced anti-dabbing posters, drawing a connection between the dance and drug culture. Unlike dabbing, the Macarena is not explicitly illegal in Saudi Arabia. Many on social media were outraged, though not necessarily surprised, by the arrest of the young boy and the implication that authorities spent a considerable amount of time tracking him down. There were, however, others on social media in Saudi Arabia who supported the boy's arrest. The U.S. is still a firm ally of Saudi Arabia, despite the existence of video footage of high-ranking U.S. officials both dabbing and doing the Macarena.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Isabel Cochran, Kunzel Dolma, Tom Flynn, and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Ben Chiragi. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani and Lynn take your calls. At 9, One Land, Many Voices explores the political, social, and cultural issues affecting Palestine and Israel. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Pacific Underground presents real-time coverage of issues affecting Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Northwest. KABU keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Thank you for listening to the KABU Evening News. I'm Sam Bowman. On Tuesday, the president held one of his notorious campaign-style rallies in Phoenix, Arizona. While he spoke and shouted to a large audience, many of whom had waited for hours in 100-plus degree heat, thousands of counter-protesters gathered outside. Phoenix Cop Watch is a police watchdog group in the area. They have a long history, including standing up to often unchecked profiling and abuses of power by Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Arpaio was indicted in federal court this summer for ignoring rules about profiling suspects, but the president intimated at Tuesday's rally that he would probably pardon Arpaio ahead of his sentencing hearing in October. I spoke this afternoon with Dan Hemry of Phoenix Cop Watch, who was at Tuesday's counter-protest. Dan, can you just tell me a little bit about the counter-protest on Tuesday night? What was your vantage point there? Were you there as a member of Cop Watch, or were you there as a protester?
Well, I was there as a protester. I wasn't there as Cop Watch. I did film. I put one video up on YouTube from it. Took a few still shots and mostly help people out with heat exhaustion.
About how many people, just from your vantage point, would you say were there protesting against the rally?
At any given moment, there was probably 3,000 to 5,000 people in the small free speech zone that was designated for them.
Okay.
But, it was probably closer to 15,000 over a period of 4 hours.
Okay. And it was set up as in the with the sort of free speech zone model?
It was zoned, and it had barricades and surrounding it entirely. It was really kind of sad because there were so many more people than could fit in that area that thousands of people would come in and thousands would leave and more thousands would arrive.
About how many police would you say were there?
I would say probably less than 50 to start with, around, let's say, 7 o'clock. And then as the night progressed, it got to be probably 200 to 400.
To the extent that you're able to answer this, did it seem to be primarily Phoenix PD, or were there other agencies involved?
You know, it was hard to tell. It seemed like it was primarily the Phoenix Police Department.
Can you give us an idea what the makeup of the crowd was?
Yeah, I took a good walk through. It was a variety of folks. A real cross-section of the city was there. There were LGBT protesting. There was Antifa, and they were in Black Bloc. Just a huge, huge cross-section of the city was there.
Yeah, and so in Phoenix, leading up to this event, how would you describe the mood in the city leading up to it? I mean, I understand it is one of the more, I guess, Trump-leaning states, but did the city of Phoenix feel like it was welcoming the president on Tuesday?
Well, I know the mayor asked him to not come, so that started it off. And then we were expecting a pardon for our wonderful ex-sheriff, Arpaio.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people were really jacked up about that. And so a lot of the signs were kind of skewed between that and between Trump. So some of them were, you can't pardon hate, and those type of themes. And then others were more directed at the president.
It was said by the Phoenix Police Department that they began their clearance operation, tear gas, pepper spray, pepper balls. They had seen projectiles being thrown from the crowd, including gas in some form, gas canisters or something. Did you see anything that would indicate that's true?
No. There were folks that were assigned to do de-escalation, and they were specifically going to anybody who looked like they were about to, you know, bust out. And so they would go and help de-escalate fights and de-escalate protesters that were just getting too wild, we'll call it. But at the time that they actually started their volleys of pepper spray, the film from it and all of the indications are there was nothing that set them off. There was a group that was ready to split off and march towards the Capitol, but they basically got the first round of pepper spray with a bunch of elderly people, children. They were from a church, United Church of Christ. They had planned a march that was going to leave the protest area and go towards the Capitol. And that was right around the time that everything kind of let loose.
To your knowledge, did anyone get taken to the hospital because of pepper spray?
There was that one kid that he kicked the canister back towards them. He was in blue shorts, and he ran up and kicked the canister, whatever was spewing out of it, back towards them, and then they shot him in the groin with another canister.
With a canister?
Yeah, that's what it looked like, because it seemed like there was, like, more smoke coming out of it when it hit him, and then he went down, and people had to grab him from the middle of the street and take him off to the side.
Well, you're definitely talking about a projectile bigger than, like, a pepper ball or something.
Yes, and it looked like a canister. And there's good footage of that. I've seen some really good footage that were people right there in front of him practically and filmed it. There was others that shot it from above, from a parking garage. But the guy clearly was injured. I don't know what happened to him, but everybody else who got injured from it was mostly from eyes and irritation, and some people threw up.
it caught everybody off guard, but then we had medics that were present to help. And there were people with gas masks that went into the fog and brought people out of it that couldn't get themselves up and out of there. And they were treated on the scene. The only people that went to the hospital were two people from heat exhaustion. The other 56 people that were treated for heat exhaustion, I don't think any of them ended up in the hospital.
You were there as a private citizen, but you are also a member of Phoenix Cop Watch. How does this square with other protest events and the police's response to protest events in Phoenix? Is this pretty typical, or is it tame, or more than you would expect? Or,
well, let's see. I was thinking back to when the last time was that the police had lined up like this and squared off against everybody. There's been a few immigrant protests that didn't end quite that way, and then there was Occupy, which would be 2011. But since Occupy, I can't really recall any major actions by the police in Phoenix that used this level of weaponry and stuff like that. I've seen it in other cities, way more intense than it was here. But here, the Occupy one was where the police tricked them into going to a park off-site from where they were, and then they basically surrounded them, made them sit down, and arrested each one at a time. Right. And I don't remember, but maybe one person got pepper spray, but it was so docile and so complacent that they really haven't had I just can't recall of any other times, really, in the last, let's say, 6-7 years, really, that they've done anything like this.
Interesting. Did Cop Watch have much interaction with the county sheriffs under Joe Arpaio?
Well, our first interaction that was done on behalf of immigrants was in 2006, and we approached the sheriff with a group of us, and he had a whole bunch of reporters, and kind of crashed what we were doing, and so we had to confront him directly. But it was over him having people arrested and then convicting themselves for being their own coyote.
Huh.
I guess the state law said you weren't supposed to be a coyote, and so it was a more harsh punishment. And so it required that they self-incriminate.
And these are people who, I guess, were, traveling by themselves or were arrested by themselves?
I suppose that's right. It was a trick. The law was passed about dealing with coyotes, and then Maricopa sheriffs decided to arrest people and get them to try and indict themselves, self-incriminate, which is not supposed to happen. And we confronted him about that and asked him to stop using the law the way it wasn't intended. That was before the massive marches, and so the massive marches took place maybe the next year in 2007 or 8, and that was definitely one of those things that we zeroed in on early and were first up to really confront the sheriff's department directly and Arpaio directly about that.
And Arpaio, especially outside of Arizona and up here, he is he's this totemic figure who represents a certain way of policing the border. But now that he is out of office, has anything changed with the Maricopa County sheriffs?
Well, they were supposed to close the concentration camp they called Tent City, and they haven't closed it yet. I guess there's still 200 people languishing in the heat over there in the tent. So that hasn't changed. I'm not hearing a lot of reports of profiling, which is the case that he was involved in, and eventually he was convicted of going against the judge's order, the contempt order, and he was convicted of that. But the whole profiling operations, where he would go out and pull over brown people and see how many people he could get, and then tear up all the documentation so nobody could prove that he did it, and then also these raids on employers that were just random and swept up everybody and those type of things, we haven't had any of those in several years.
And are people in Phoenix that you know of reacting to the potential that seems pretty likely that Arpaio will be pardoned by the president?
Well, it took many years to get that conviction of him, and lots of people worked on the project. We filmed them stopping people and documented what they did so that, you know, our documentation won because they didn't have any. They tore all theirs up. And so that took a lot of manpower and a lot of time and effort to follow them around and follow them for their stop and bring the body of evidence that eventually was used in that case. So everybody had a stake in it for a long time to get him even just slightly, you know, held accountable for what he did. And if he's pardoned, it really is a slap in the face to all the people who worked on those projects to prove that profiling was taking place and that he was constantly going against the judge and various other rules and regulations that don't allow for that.
Dan, I think I'll let you go for now, but is there anything you'd like to add?
You know, there was a march in Phoenix, a Nazi rally march in 2009, that I recall, and they were going to the Federal Plaza to probably support the SB 1070, which is, you know, show me your papers by the law, and they were mad that they weren't enforcing it enough. We shut them down before they even got to the plaza and delayed them for 2 hours before they made it there because they got lost. To just wrap it up, basically ever since we shut down that Nazi march, because they did make it to the plaza and they did, you know, go home, but they have never formed up another meeting of the Nazis in public to do one of their public rallies here since 2009, and that's because we were so effective at shutting them down.
Oh, great. That's definitely of interest to us up here. We've been had about three or four of them just this summer.
Yeah, it really takes a concerted community effort and to stay on top of it. And you can keep it from happening if you start right away and early and often. And we proved that. And we have yet to see them pull that trick here again.
Oh, great. So I've been speaking with Dan Hemry of Phoenix Cop Watch down in Phoenix, Arizona. Dan, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome, Sam. Pleasure.
For KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, I'm Sam Bowman.
Said we both just needed time to make sure we can get it right. Time to think about you and me. We need some time to just be free. But baby, that ain't where I wanna be. Sit here with me.
wishing I could hold you tight. That ain't how I see. That ain't how I see being free.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 o'clock. Up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.